You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
What is education for? The oldest grand library which I have any knowledge of is the tablet collection of the Assyrian Emperor Ashurbanipal. And as far as I can tell, it's mainly a collection of magic spells for the court sorcerers to draw from when they need this or that kind of wizardry. And on the other end of things, chronologically speaking, in our little corner of the 21st century, some colleges now seem to advertise exclusively, or pretty dang near exclusively, what kinds of financial benefits their schools offer to those who enroll. Folks who have heard the Christian Humanist Radio Network talk about education over the years know that we tend to favor visions of educations from somewhere in between historically and nowhere in the vicinity theologically, and that's why I'm excited to have Dr. Jeffrey Bilbrow and Dr. David Henriksen on the show to talk about the liberating arts, why we need liberal arts education from Plow Press. This collection, which they edited with Jessica Hooten Wilson, doesn't really get into the sorcery end of things, not that urgent anymore, I suppose, but have a good deal to say about the aspirations and visions of education that in our 21st century moment stand as a compelling and faithful call to Christian communities concerned with teaching what's most worth teaching. Davey, Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Jeff, since you two are editors rather than the authors of most of this volume, I'm going to ask you most of these questions kind of as a fellow reader. But a phrase occurs in the book's introduction that you two both had a pen on that drew my attention, so I'm going to start there. The editors say a little bit about writing as a Christian humanist. I'm pretty sure that phrase is in there. What does that phrase mean when these editors write it? And couldn't you have given the podcast network at least a footnote?
Sorry about that, Nathan. Yeah, I mean, I have been listening to Christian Humanist podcast for quite a long time. And I think the kind of, you alluded to this in the intro too, right? The kind of approach to education that you all take and talk about and banter around is certainly congruent with what we're after in this project. And that part of the intro and the framework that it names, right, where we say many of the authors in this collection are writing from and working in Christian contexts. So we're going to, you know, use that lens when we talk about this kind of education. That's probably been one of the more controversial parts of the book, or the parts that I get the most questions about. Some Christians, I think, want like all the book to be explicitly Christian, and then some non-Christian readers feel maybe a little blindsided when they get to some of the chapters and they see that there's a pretty robust theological framework here. So that's a trick. You know, we talk about this with Plow and during the editorial meetings, how should we frame this? But the goal is to say, like, there are definitely places for collaboration across faith traditions and then with people of no faith on these questions. And yet, our faith traditions also shape how we view human flourishing and the point of education, the ends of education. And I think to some extent, a liberal arts education does imply or point toward a kind of non-materialist view of the human person, right? That humans are created for, oriented toward non-material ends. And so obviously, Davey and myself and Jessica and most of the contributors, not all of them, understand that in peculiarly Christian terms.
And Davey, just to follow up on that, I mean, one of the phrases that Jeff threw out there is the ends of education, which immediately brings to my memory, you know, Neil Postman's book, The Ends of Education. And I mean, you know, Postman is writing, you know, largely from a sort of secular Jewish perspective and really more secular than Jewish. So, I mean, you know, the idea that education should form the human person, you know, is not exclusive to really any kind of metaphysics, much less any kind of particular confession. In your experience, I mean, you know, has this become, and we're going to talk about more about this later, but I mean, has this become a kind of dividing line, if you will, in debates about education, or you know, are the people who are really debating it, do they tend to line up on the formation side, and the people who are not debating it but just passing policy line up on the other side? Go with you where you will on that, because I didn't think about that question enough before I started talking.
No, it's a great question. I suppose first I can just offer a little bit of historical context for how the project emerged, which could get actually a long way to answering your question, which is that as we write about in the introductory chapter, this project came out of quarantine. And it came out of a moment in which I had just been sent home by my university, my former university, with a looming threat of furlough or job termination on the line that affected quite a few of us, including, of course, Jeff shares his own story about that. But my thought in that moment, being at home, being isolated, was I just wanted to talk about this with my friends, friends who were in similar spaces, vocationally, institutionally. And so the original group that was kind of drawn in was just folks who I knew would be interesting thought partners to raise questions about, like, the viability of our project and about the idea of doing liberal arts in a world that seemed to be thrown into chaos instantaneously. And so the project emerged without any sort of preset boundaries about who was in and who was out. It was really just a network of friends who I think were drawn together by a similar set of questions. And that's actually, I think I would say, it's how I would explain how the book came to be too, although I'd be curious for Jeff's perspective on this as well. But I wouldn't say that we went into the project or the book manuscript with this idea of, like, setting boundaries about which traditions were in and which traditions were out, but rather we just kind of drew folks together who were magnetized by the set of orienting questions about how should education form us? Is there sort of an ultimate telos to who we are as human beings that transcends our marketability and our job skills? And so it was rather, you know, a set of instincts, questions, concerns, and even anxieties that kind of were cultivated in that kind of tenuous post-quarantine space than a question about, you know, which religious traditions can be permitted entry into the conversation.
And that makes good sense. And I mean, that drives me towards, you know, my next question, which is that, you know, one of the strong differences, and I actually didn't think about articulating it this way till I just now heard you talk, is that, you know, one difference between these two aspirations for education is that one might actually grant that you need to be formed for certain kinds of work. But the kind of education you guys are talking about seems to say that you need to be formed to rest properly. And in fact, you know, David, you and Zena Hitz draw readers' attention to the ways that reading and rest relate to each other. And then later in the book, Brad East connects that relationship with politics. And one of the political goals that resonated with me, to be sure, is a call to, you know, form communities where human beings can rest and read. Now, I bring these connections up because one of the most frequent metaphors folks use to attack liberal arts is the ivory tower. And that at least implies, you know, insularity or maybe even a separation from politics rather than a connection to, you know, sort of the hurly-burly of human community. So once again, take this where you will, because my question's turning into a rant. But, you know, what would advocates for liberal learning have to say about this idea that, you know, learning is a kind of withdrawal? Or what's the difference between rest and withdrawal for you?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a range of instincts on that very question within the contributing author list. We've actually had a lot of conversations about that. And, you know, on one end, I think Zena, I mean, she's written about this at book length as well, is quite invested in the idea of leisure or rest or the contemplative life as being sort of the end of liberal arts education. And in this mindset, I suppose one kind of overly simplistic way to put that would be that the active life could be a distraction to the contemplative life. And others of us, and I think I find myself somewhere in the middle, others were much more drawn to questions about pragmatics, about how the liberal arts can be useful as opposed to intentionally useless. And that's a very interesting discussion and internal debate actually within the editors and the authors. For me, when I write about this idea of Sabbath at the beginning of the book, for me, again, emerging out of the specific context of quarantine and COVID, rest was not an end that I sought, that it was a necessity Like, we were thrown into rest. We were thrown into isolation and lack of possible activity. We couldn't get into our classrooms. And so for me, reflecting upon it in a vocational sense, it was a forced Sabbath in which we actually had to kind of think about first principles. Like this, I suppose we could have just thrown up our hands and gotten frustrated or resentful. And many of us probably did at various moments throughout those couple of years. But for me, it was an occasion to, well, let's make use of the time that we have to contemplate what this is for. And again, when it comes to like the ends of liberal arts as such, again, there's some internal debate about that. For me, I think it has to be some sort of mixture of the active and the contemplative life that for me constitutes human flourishing. And there were debates in the early modern context in which I specialize, which were actually very keen to discuss this. And I think I find myself as a sort of somebody with Weberian and Calvinist anxieties about a lack of work and activeness. And so I fall maybe slightly on that side more than Zena does. But anyway, it's been an interesting question. That's something that's actually fueled many of our kind of internal conversations as well.
Well, that's interesting. I've spent so much time teaching Dante that the image that immediately comes to my mind is the Leah and Rachel allegory at the end of Purgatorio, where, you know, for Dante, the contemplative life is decidedly the better way. So it's interesting. I mean, you know, I think you're right that, you know, Weber's insight is that, you know, that has been inverted in our moment historically. Jeff, you look like you might want to chime in on that. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think just a second Davey's point about this is one of the more points of one of the maybe the more clearest lines of demarcation and within the contributors, right? Some people really wanted to argue that the liberal arts were useless. And I am pleased with the way that we laid it out that and when I talk to students and parents, I think it's helpful to kind of take a both and approach. Like the active life and the contemplative life are both good. They're both appropriate to the human condition, but maybe at certain times culturally they get out of balance. And I suppose if you tied me down, I would side with Dante that ultimately the active life is subordinate to the contemplative life. That seems to line up not just with Leah and Rachel, but also with Mary Martha. But I think it's not at all unreasonable for students to be concerned about what are the economic payoffs of these degrees that are costing so much money. So I think you really do have to address the economic and pragmatic concerns as well.
Well, let's talk about one of those, you know, common complaints about liberal arts, and that is that, you know, it teaches everyone to be philosophy and English majors and end up as baristas. I mean, one of the things that, you know, runs through this book is the idea that liberal arts are finding homes and still can find homes in places outside of academic departments. And, you know, there's chapters about, you know, liberal arts in prisons, online groups, no cost or low cost community centers, different kinds of schools. Jeff, I mean, you know, actually, now that I think of it, you know, you could even imagine maybe a podcast network that was dedicated to such things. Right. But Jeff, talk about one or two of those things and don't talk about me. My ego's already inflated.
Well, I have to talk about you because just 2 weeks ago, I was at a small Mennonite college giving a talk and somebody came up to me and said that he got his degree at a secular state school and he considers and he went through a kind of intellectual formation process and ended up changing careers and wanting to teach, take a lot less money to teach at this small Mennonite college. And he said, like, one of the key roles of his intellectual formation was listening to Christian Humanist Podcast Network. So I absolutely think that podcasts can be one of these opportunities to invite people into conversation about big ideas, about books, about reading, and about what humans do well, I think the tagline is. So, yeah, one of the things that, as David pointed out, right, this is coming, these questions are sparked by this moment of institutional crisis. And a lot of us were wondering whether or not we had a future in kind of traditional higher ed. Some of us who worked in the project, you know, aren't in that arena, but most of us were and are. And so I think part of the project was to think if small liberal arts colleges end up foundering, and if there are many fewer of them in the coming decades, where else might this kind of formation take place? Because clearly it's a kind of education, a kind of formation, a kind of vision for the human person that far predates the current institutional forms that that we have today. So it goes before the typical liberal arts college was founded, and it will endure even if this instantiation of the sort of institutional model fails. So that's why we, tried to look far afield. And I think some of the most encouraging parts of the book are these stories about whether it's the Odyssey Project that brings kind of great books, education to low-income folks who don't have access to the traditional college model, or Zena Hitz's Catherine Project that has been insanely popular, right? Far beyond her expectations, where people want to discuss ultimate ideas with small groups and a mentor, a guide to lead them through it. So I think those are really encouraging. And also, podcasts or things like these small magazines, whether it's Comment or Plow that we featured, but there's many more. We did some stuff with The Point. So I think when you, sometimes in higher ed, we kind of focus on ourselves and we can get this very gloomy picture because like, oh, the economics of higher ed are challenged right now. But if you cast a bit of a broader perspective, you can see all kinds of places where there's a real hunger for formative, liberating education. It's a human desire, and it's going to be met in some fashion, even if it might not look like what we expect.
Very good. Very good. Well, David, to return to the colleges for a moment, let's talk about the other side of that coin. What do Christians or Americans or other human communities lose when liberal arts colleges stop doing liberal arts or close entirely? The neighborhoods that I hang out in online have a lot of calls for the renewal of the Christian liberal arts college. Are calls for Christian college in particular to preserve liberal arts worth the time and attention and energy?
Well, yes. But well, here's why. When I've started to see in the landscape of Christian higher education in particular is a redrawing of various boundary markers or battle lines, even along issues that kind of trace the culture war, as opposed to a pursuit of things like truth, beauty, and goodness in and of themselves. And that concerns me. And I, in my own vocation, which is a quasi-administrator, quasi-faculty member, I kind of have had to dabble in both sides of that world. And I understand the draw of drawing the lines in that way and attracting a constituency, donors, prospective students, et cetera, with an either ideological or political summons. And I am concerned about that. And not because politics or ideology are irrelevant to a liberal arts education, but because I worry if those are the primary motivation for why parents choose to send their kids one direction or another. And it seems to me that what is most attractive to me about the liberal arts tradition and the Christian liberal arts tradition specifically is that there is the virtue of inquisitiveness that wants to pursue truth and goodness wherever it leads you. And that sometimes that forces you to cross the battle lines that you had drawn for yourself previously and to find yourself occupying spaces and entering into friendships and alliances with folks that you may not have expected to in the first instance based on your own unique context. And so for me, I worry that if we allow the liberal arts tradition to decline, and here I'm thinking specifically within the Christian college world, which is where we are currently located, that something else will take its place. And I worry that ideology will be the thing, a sort of identitarian politics of the left or the right will supplant this more historic way of approaching the human person and human education.
Jeff, let's pursue that a little bit, because the essays in this volume counter accusations that liberal arts are racist projects really resonated with me, largely because I'm enough of a historicist to raise an eyebrow when anyone accuses you know, texts and paintings and artifacts from before, I mean, really the European colonial empires of being white supremacists. That term doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me before the ships start making their long voyages. But say a little bit about Angel Adams Parham and her reflections on Africa's place in the Great Conversation.
Yeah, and I think this speaks too to what Davey was just articulating, this need to, I think it's a need anyway, to frame the liberal arts education as a kind of pre-political good that we should be able to agree upon and embrace this kind of formative project with people from, yeah, different cultures, different ethnicities, and different political persuasions. But certainly in certain institutions and cultures, the liberal arts institutions have been elitist and have been reserved for certain races, certain genders, certain classes. So and we taught, you know, there's a couple chapters in the book that kind of work through this, both on an economic side and then the racial side. But I think Angel's project, both in this chapter and her book with Anika, The Black Intellectual Tradition, does a really great job of showing how this kind of vision of the human person, this desire for an education that forms people to be capable of the intellectual life and intellectual friendship, is both native to Africa and also should include African Americans and people from other ethnicities. So Angel's chapter, I think, opens those doors. And I think, you know, Christian colleges are doing an uneven job in demonstrating the accessibility of their education. I think in interesting ways, the K-12 classical school movement, some of those institutions are even doing a better job. And part of it is a lot of people from, you know, class backgrounds or racial backgrounds where they maybe haven't had a tradition of having access to this kind of education, see the liberal arts education as that kind of formation that, you know, the quote unquote elites get, and they want access to that too. And so when these institutions find ways to make that education accessible, when they locate it in these communities, right, and not like pull them out, then they're insanely popular. So to me, that's really encouraging. And we were really glad that Angel would kind of join the project and draw from her experience to make that case in the book.
That's good. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, occurs to me as we're, again, talking about, you know, some of the partisan accusations is that, you know, my own impulse is to say that any kind of appeal to the liberal arts is inherently political, but it might be something that is extra partisan rather than non-political, which, you know, I mean, some people might say that's just change of terms, but I think the terms are important there. Yeah. But the reason I'm driving that direction is that, you know, Jonathan Haidt is another conversation partner in this book. And I believe it's Joseph Clare's chapter that is dialoguing with Haidt. And, you know, Haidt does have kind of a different kind of politics, right? You know, he talks about truth you versus justice you. And he says that ultimately truth you, which, you know, the way that I read Haidt is still political, but it's a different kind of politics, is superior. And what I like is that Clare, his vision for it, I mean, strikes me still as political, but not as partisan, right? That the Christ you is something that, you know, wants to hold in tension the goods of truth you and justice you, but in ways that are not generic by any means, but that really do come from somewhere and are going somewhere. And Jeff, I don't know why I am lecturing today, but I should be posing you guys questions. You're the editors. Talk a little bit about Jonathan Haidt.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think Judd does a nice job in this chapter of, as you put it, acknowledging like there's real goods here in pursuing truth in a kind of disinterested way that the Enlightenment mode of reason particularly has developed. But there's also real goods in recognizing that truth is a social project. You know, the pursuit of truth is a social project, and that is one that does have a real world implications, and we should be concerned about its the effects of the pursuit and the construction of knowledge. Hence the kind of social justice progressive activist view of knowledge these days. And so what I appreciate about Joe's chapter is he's trying to envision how a Christian university oriented to, you know, Christ as the person of truth might be able to hold both of those in tension in ways that check the excesses of each when they're left to develop on their own direction. So I think, you know, clearly Joe's been deeply formed by Augustine. I think this is kind of, maybe to your point about partisan versus politics, maybe this is a kind of Augustinian mode of politics, right? A Christian polis that's trying to inhabit and enact the city of God, even within the city of man. But Davey knows a lot more about Augustine than I do, so I shouldn't say too much about that.
Well, actually, what I want to say is not about Augustine, but about this topology. And I think, you know, one of the things that so Joe's borrowing from Haidt's, you know, Jesus you, truth you, and social justice you. Topologies, and as a teacher, I know they serve a useful pedagogical function sometimes by setting out emphases or strains and allowing you to kind of compare and contrast. And so I think Joe's essay does an admirable job about drawing out different strains or different, I guess you'd say different ethoi, different ethoses, you know, that are might occupy certain or animate certain university cultures. But of course, every topology runs out of steam eventually, because when you get to an actual particular academic community, it usually fails to fully, you know, explain what's going on. And so for me, maybe the limitations of the topology are this. You know, Joe and I actually were educated at the same, in the same doctoral program at Princeton, and had shared many of the same advisors. And speaking for myself, my experience there, what you would have expected to be maybe some version of a truth you or social justice you culture, there was actually a very substantive engagement with moral and religious questions and values. Like, in my experience there, we took those things very seriously. We had practitioners of various faiths, evangelical, mainline, Muslim, Jewish, agnostic, etc. And we were all concerned with these sort of ultimate or transcendent questions. And we never, at least I will speak for myself, I never felt as if I had to sideline those because they didn't fit into a social justice you or a truth you box. And by contrast, or perhaps by comparison, you know, I work now at a sort of evangelical type Christian college where there's a very strong social justice culture here, and a pretty strong activist culture as well, on the left and the right. But so for me, I think these topologies maybe help to diagnose certain cultural trends or even ailments. But in my own experience, these things tend to get, they're a lot more complicated when you actually look at particular communities. And I suppose the pursuit of justice or the pursuit of truth or the pursuit of ultimate meaning to the person of Jesus, they don't have to be, you know, mutually exclusive pursuits.
Right. And I think, I mean, and I'm trying to remember, what was he working from, a Haidt's book, The Coddling of the American Mind, or a different one?
I think so.
Okay, because that's one that I read. And if I remember right, the sort of test cases that Haidt was digging at were these particular cases. I won't say that it's true of the whole institution, but particular cases where, you know, there were certain lines of inquiry that, you know, if they were brought up in class, then people at best, you know, looked at them with suspicion, and at worst said, we need to outlaw those from the classroom because even inquiring into those does harm. And of course, you know, Haidt, as, you know, someone who styles himself as a classical liberal, of course, found that horrifying. But Davey, I mean, your point is well taken that, you know, every institution has its own margin cases like that, and then also probably has its own, to steal a phrase from Thomas Kuhn, you know, normal science, the day-to-day workings of an institution like that. Well, Davey, I want to go a different direction here, and that's the direction of relevance. In the book's pieces that explore this notion of relevance, the phrase quote, ecosystem of understanding, end quote, really caught my attention. So what does that environmental metaphor capture about learning broadly and liberal arts learning as a mode of broad learning?
Yeah. Well, for me, I think this is a line from Noah Tolle's essay. And Noah was a really important partner, by the way, throughout the project, even though he didn't join us as one of the co-editors for the book manuscript, but a key contributor along the way. And conversations with Noah and Jessica and Jeff, I think a lot of us kind of came to a fuller understanding of just how much of liberal arts education takes place beyond a disciplinary classroom. And so, you know, each of us has our own, you know, scholarly expertise. I published my first book as an academic monograph that probably 14 people have read within my subfield. So I get that and I respect that very much.
My first book as well, man. My first book as well.
The struggle is real. But, you know, beyond that, I think one of the things I've learned over the last decade or so in these sort of small liberal arts Christian spaces is that, one, the liberal arts are not, I don't think, primarily a series of discrete topics or disciplines. Rather, they are a way of life, a way of approaching intellectual, but perhaps also moral and spiritual formation. They are about the cultivation of certain practices, habits, and virtues. They are about trying to live a fully, you know, integrated life, according to whatever, you know, vision of human flourishing we sort of are living out. But also, like I said, this way of life can't just be contained to the classroom. And so when you have a broader sense of the ecosystem of the pursuit of wisdom, this is going to take place in many different spaces. It's going to occupy spaces across campus, in student life, in chapel, if you have one, in the classroom, of course, through co-curricular programming, et cetera, through international travel and study abroad. And for me, you know, one of the stories I write about in the book is this Marilynne Robinson book club that a number of my colleagues and I, this was, I guess, maybe 7 or 8 years ago now, did. It was a number of English and theology faculty and majors associated with those fields. And we spent an entire year reading through, at that time, the four novels of Marilynne Robinson, and then took a road trip to see her speak at a conference at the end of the spring semester. And the conversations that happened in those book clubs, which were hosted in faculty members' homes over dinner or drinks or something like that, and then conversations that happened on the road trip, I found those to be some of the most memorable experiences that I had as a teacher. And I had several of the students come back to me at the end of the year, and then one many years later actually come back and just note how formative those conversations were. And for me, it struck me that that typically wouldn't happen at, say, a very large state research university where the goals and the values are just different. And I'm not even right now making a value claim about which way is better. I'm just saying they probably won't happen. The conditions aren't such that these things will happen in a way they can at a university that's scaled down and that has a much more distinctive sense of a moral or religious way of life. So I find that to be a really key insight that I gained throughout the process of actually writing this book and editing this book with the others.
Right. And if I could offer an example that's not necessarily a counterexample, but maybe an example that complicates it. When I was a graduate student at the University of Georgia, I was part of that kind of a group, but it wasn't a university-wide kind of a thing. It was specifically associated with the Christian Faculty Forum. It was a group of professors and grad students who, you know, were part of kind of a sub-community within, you know, the larger university world. So I think that your point certainly stands there, even as, you know, I have an example of geographically, it did happen, you know, in a classroom building at the University of Georgia, but it was not it wouldn't be quite true to call it a University of Georgia event. Exactly. Well, Jeff, I want to go to one of my favorite chapters from, you know, one of my favorite writers, actually two of my favorite writers, Greg Jones and one Jeff Bilbro. And it has to do with the idea of jazz as a metaphor for what this kind of liberal learning can do. So talk a little bit about that metaphor of, what a jazz master learns from a tradition and what tradition has to do with liberal arts learning.
Yeah, I thought that Greg does a nice job kind of laying out that metaphor and using that, I guess, to make tangible this idea that if you want to innovate, if you want to develop a tradition, if you want to come up with new forms of art or new forms of knowledge or new solutions to problems, you can't start from square one, right? You have to go back and understand, not in this context, right? Not just jazz, but like longer music traditions.
Miles Davis studied medieval music, right, to make Kind of Blue.
Yeah. So you got to go back and see what people have done, sometimes far afield, and that then shapes your imagination and enables you to envision possibilities that you would not have seen before. And I just think for all kinds of reasons, culturally right now, there is this sense that we got to, you know, move fast and break things, that we have to innovate and come up with new ideas for new problems, whether it's climate change or, you know, technology stuff, and this sense that anything that happened 50 years ago is definitely irrelevant. And part of it is just the information ecosystem we inhabit, the social media, internet stuff, where, you know, things consume our collective attention for a short time and then are totally forgotten. So I think the liberal arts can invite students into a different pattern of thought that helps them to understand both how history has shaped their own assumptions about the world, and then also gives them access to other traditions, other possibilities, other ways of being, that then might help them innovate and come up with creative new solutions that are elegant and that draw on this rich heritage. Because you know, we can't reinvent the wheel every life cycle, every lifespan.
Right, and I can see Davey wants to chime in on that, but before he does, I know that in Stanley Hauerwas's book on Bonhoeffer, he's got an extended passage using jazz as a metaphor for, you know, tradition and innovation within tradition, things like that. So now I'm curious to know what kinds of conversations were happening at Duke Divinity School 15 years ago that got both of these writers going that direction. But Davey, chime in on that.
Yeah, I really like both Greg and Jeff's writing in general, but this idea of also tradition to innovation. You know, when I in my graduate training, we were constantly told that both understanding our tradition, where our 2 feet were planted, and also being able to do internal and external critique from that tradition were equally important tasks. And that it's impossible for us not to have our 2 feet planted somewhere. So we have to understand where we stand, what the ground is, where we live, but then also not to assume that we're going to stand in that same place forever. And so for me, one of my concerns about a lot of the discourse surrounding the liberal arts is that, like I said earlier, it has become somewhat politicized and often is now, I think sometimes ironically to me, associated with conservative politics. And in fact, there was just a piece by Emma Green that I think came out just yesterday or the day before in the New Yorker, investigating the world of classical liberal arts education, a world that I am actually quite familiar with myself. And it's an excellent piece. Emma's writing and reporting on these things is typically, you know, excellent and nuanced, and it's worth reading. But it does seem to me that when you talk about the liberal arts or when you talk about tradition, there are a lot of assumptions being made about where you must stand politically or about what your relationship is to the tradition in which you stand. And one thing I think, speaking for myself, but I'd be curious if Jeff would agree with this, that we really wanted to do when you're inviting contributors to this book and lifting up certain voices and certain conversation topics, was we wanted folks who took the tradition seriously but weren't afraid to critique it. So this is why, you know, Angels and Annika's, like, their contributions were so singular. Jonathan Tran's piece on how we critique the canon. Like, these are voices that I think need to be part of the tradition of liberal arts discourse. And here, just cribbing from McIntyre, like, if we stop arguing about our tradition, it's dead.
Yeah.
And so that was a very important thing for me kind of coming to this project as well.
And listeners, I'm just going to note at this point that Davey, not I, made the first McIntyre reference. Go ahead, Jeff. Chime in on that.
Well, I just to concur with Davey and say, I think he's so right. And that's why I do think, so maybe it's not pre-political, but maybe it's a sort of political point rather than a partisan point. Like, so many people give lip service to the past or give lip service to the tradition, but they don't know it, right? It's this sort of, I have three things I know about it, and it's a kind of brand or a meme. And so that's why I think, yeah, Jonathan Tran's piece is so great, because he says, hey, the canon matters. And hence debates about the canon matter. So he's not just throwing out the canon and saying, let's just all read things that are in the last 5 years. It doesn't matter. Let's have all our classes about, whatever superficial pop culture thing just happened. But he's also not saying, well, clearly whatever has been taught must be taught and there's no debates about it, right? Like, these debates matter. And I think in this moment, because of the sort of partisan nature of our culture wars, that perspective is in danger of getting forgotten on both sides. And so we're trying to, I think, say, hey, you know, people across, you might land in a different place. You might decide to read certain books and elevate certain books, and somebody else might decide things differently. And hopefully we have institutions that do that, you know, so there's a kind of healthy ecosystem here. But these debates matter, and we need to engage them in good faith and listen to other people and recognize that our traditions have to be contested if they are going to stay alive. That we're all working within a tradition, and it's not like some monolithic thing, but it's a living act, not a dead noun.
Right, right. And, you know, one of the places where, you know, and this is one of my pet peeves, and listeners, if you've heard me go off on this, just ride along. You know whose podcast you're listening to, so just stay on for the ride. But in these chapters, Davey, I mean, you know, the phrase best practices comes up. And that's always been one of my pet peeves because, first of all, it's a phrase that I heard more in Christian college circles than I ever have anywhere else. But it just strikes me as an anti-philosophical phrase because it assumes that we all already agree on what is good about what we're doing, that debate's over. Now it's just, you know, the only thing left to talk about is how we get there. So am I reading my own old age and grumpiness into this critique of best practices, or is that in the book too?
Well, you've said it yourself, Nathan. But no, I think, you know, when people refer to best practices, they could be using it in a sort of just very ordinary language sense of, oh, here's the best thing to do. And we use the term best practices to apply to that. That's fine. I think, you know, it's good to assume good faith when folks are doing that. But I do think there's a more technical use of that term as a term of art. It does kind of lend itself to a sort of unreflective utilitarian logic, which is that, okay, we all know that we're seeking the best outcome. We all know what that outcome ought to be. And therefore, here's the most effective, efficient, technocratic way to get there. And that, yeah, I think that is worthy of your pet peeve ire. And I think one of the temptations about thinking in this latter sense, using the best practices more as a technical term of art, is that it kind of elides all the interesting conversation about what human beings are and what we were made for. And it certainly seems to preclude, in my experience, a substantive conversation about the virtues that constitute human flourishing, because it's focusing so much on in the most efficient outcome, or again, a sort of predetermined, you know, best approach to something, as opposed to thinking about the actual human beings involved and the spaces and practices of formation that help them to become, you know, their best selves. So I give you a qualified endorsement of your pet peeves.
Well, and it's interesting because not long after that chapter, we get to Rachel Griffiths's chapter that, you know, has a pretty extended treatment of Robert Detweiler's book, The Evidence Liberal Arts Needs, which, if anything, is a sort of quantification and a, you know, statistical analysis of liberal arts, which, you know, it's one of those, you know, how badly do I need allies questions, because, you know, a certain number of things that he does just strike me as, you know, the wrong questions to ask. But on the other hand, he is making the case for, you know, the kind of education that I want to persist. So all that said, Jeff, I mean, talk a little bit about, you know, what Griffiths finds in Detweiler's book, because I mean, his study doesn't end with graduation, and it doesn't even end with the year after graduation, but it's a longitudinal study. What kinds of things, even with our concerns about, you know, what kinds of questions we're asking, but what kinds of things can we learn from that kind of study?
Yeah, I mean, I think Detweiler, and just to refer to an earlier part of our conversation, right, this chapter was one of the things that was contested. Like, do you even want this chapter? But we thought, yeah, we need to answer these questions. These are fair questions, especially in a time when college costs so much, too much probably. And I think what's interesting about Detweiler's, you know, even I might quibble with his methodology in part, but it's an interesting study because it's so long. And I think he helps to surface some of the particular goods of a liberal arts education. So if you have a kind of training that's more focused on particular career skills and outcomes, then sure, those people often have an easier path from graduation to first job. But the kinds of mentor relationships, the kinds of thinking that are cultivated when you have to take courses in different disciplines and relate them together, where you have these opportunities for conversation, intellectual friendship with people from across the community and who approach these things from different angles. It shapes people who, you know, again, I hate to use a kind of business jargon, but they become leaders, right? It shapes people who are able to lead, who are able to have long-term thinking, who are able to communicate well. And so they become the leaders in various business and professional contexts. And, you know, they make more money, they have more, have higher job satisfaction, they have higher satisfaction with life in other contexts too. These capacities that make you better able to enjoy leisure, that make you hopefully better able to deal with pain and suffering that we talk about, right? All these kind of final goods of human persons. Well, they also have instrumental goods. And, you know, I think we don't have to shy away from those questions, and we should articulate those goods to parents and their students.
Right. And one interesting thing about that, and again, I didn't know that Detweiler was answering this question until I read the question posed in this book. But I mean, one of the things that Detweiler is answering is, you know, whether an education that teaches us only to work or an education that teaches us to work and to rest is the better kind of education. I mean, his answer, I mean, pretty solidly and pretty consistently seems to be the education that teaches us to rest well. Yeah. So Davey, chime in on that, because I'm talking too much again.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with everything that Jeff said. I think here, Nathan, I'm going to give you a second McIntyre reference, so you don't have to do it yourself. But, you know, McIntyre talks about the way that he compares the way we develop virtues and practices to how, say, a child learns to love the game of chess, and how in the initial instances, you might bribe a small child with candy to partake in this game and teaching, you know, incentivizing him or her to learn the rules, to play well, to play with you know, grace and justice. And then the hope, though, is at the end of that, that one begins to enjoy the game for itself. And so what was once, you know, a means to an end or instrumental good becomes an intrinsic good. And so for me, it's like when we talk to, say, prospective parents about the value of a liberal arts education, we are talking a lot of times about outcomes, because that's the questions that they bring to the table. And I think it's very important for us to remember that the liberal arts are not against good outcomes, even if good outcomes aren't solely or even principally what they are about. But sometimes I think, you know, we have to account for a whole range of human desires and fears and anxieties in the hopes of opening up a broader world and a broader set of experiences that I hope at least the liberal arts offer. And I think what Detweiler does so well is he does provide the evidence that so many of us, when we're talking to prospective parents and students, sometimes know implicitly through our years of experience as teachers and administrators, but don't always have the data set to back that up. And, you know, his, Detweiler's emphasis on, for instance, like the co-curricular component of a liberal arts education, all the things that happen outside the classroom, dovetail so nicely and kind of give me the evidence I need to say why something like the Marilynne Robinson Book Club did prove so formative for the students who were involved in it. And for me, I could have, you know, what could have been written off as just a weird one-off anecdotal piece of evidence that students really were invested in this. Detweiler does give us a story, a data-driven story that explains why something was at work there that could be at work in other such experiences. And so I find that very useful.
Very good. Very good. Jeff, early in the interview, we took on notions of leisure, and I want to start to bring us in for a landing with the idea of silence. What can we see and what can we understand in silence that we miss in our noisier moments? And what does all this have to do with liberal arts education?
Yeah, if I can follow up real quick to what Davey said on the McIntyre, you know, in that part of After Virtue, McIntyre says, hey, external goods are good too. And right, they're not, I think that's a great point that these are, we want to be gainful, our students to be gainfully employed. These are good too, even if, as Davey so well said, those aren't maybe the principal ends. And maybe that's, you know, just gets to this idea of how a liberal arts education hopefully enables us to be silent, to rest, to see these things not just as an absence of noise or not just as an absence of activity, not a kind of blank, but as a positive shape, as the shape of contemplation. You know, some people cannot sit still. They need to have something to fiddle with. And I think part of that is they need this external stimulation to take away the questions that silence poses to ourselves, sort of existential questions. So hopefully one of the outcomes, and this does sound weird, but one of the outcomes of a liberal arts education is to enable a person to be silent and in a qualitative sense, and to contemplate, to go deep, as opposed to just keep flitting from surface to surface. So, and these are hard things, I think, to practice with our students. These are hard things to grade, but that's the aspiration, that when they are confronted by death, by pain, by family suffering, by unanswerable questions, you know, the kind of things that Job faced, they have the formation needed to endure and to thrive even in those difficulties, because we're all going to face these challenges.
And I think that is what I am confronting in a new way. And listeners, I mean, you probably already know this. If you don't, I have changed careers. I'm teaching my first year of public high school. And what I have noticed in my, you know, rooms full of junior varsity athletes is that, I mean, some of them find it positively offensive that you might learn how to rest better. That, you know, whatever education is for, it's to prepare you for the work part of your life, that the whatever isn't work, it's just as good to spend all of it on your phone, spend all of it, you know, drinking beer, spend all of it, you know, doing whatever. And that, you know, the differences between, you know, a drunken oblivion and a contemplative silence are just matters of ice cream flavor. It's just whichever one you prefer, right? So, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think that is one of the rhetorical appeals that liberal arts and Christian liberal arts in particular really needs to get really good at making, is that, yes, there are better ways to work. And also, yes, there are better ways to rest. Davey, I promise you, I usually don't monologue this much during these interviews, but chime in on that.
Yeah, I mean, one idea that I've had for some time, that I actually just, I wrote a grant proposal that if we get this back, we might actually be able to try this out, was the idea of creating a leisure club. It has to be named something else, so it doesn't sound like some sleazy pianist in a hotel lobby. But
yeah, there's a series of video games that kind of militate against that name.
But the idea of kind of reclaiming this older idea of leisure or contemplation or rest as being something that is so fundamental to human flourishing, that if you don't have it, if you get caught up in the busy, frenzied, frenetic pace of modern careerist life, you're going to lose sight of, is this idea that there are things that take your, that demand your attention and demand a lot of it and demand your soul attention, whether that's means, you know, getting students out into the beautiful woods, pristine woods of Eastern Washington to talk about Augustine, or just having a series of dinner topics where everybody brings a poem and talks about the themes and emotional or spiritual resonances that the poem delivers to them. But just getting folks together where there's no agenda, where maybe there's a single point of conversation or commonality, but that the point of getting together and the point of the exercise or the activity is just resting and just contemplating something that is true or something that is utterly beautiful, something that's incandescent in its excellence. And I feel like, you know, I find that critiques of modernity often become pretty shallow when they just talk about the, you know, modern pace of life leading away from all these things, because I find that human beings are still very much capable of these sorts of moments of rest and tranquility and contemplation. But I do think it requires some more intentionality. And it seems to me that the 4 years that our young adults have at a very expensive small liberal arts college in some cases gives them, I think, an obligation to make use of that time, not to be busier, but to actually rest. Because when they graduate, they're going to have a whole life of busyness and frenzied activity and careerist ambitions that are knocking on their door every moment of the day. And in these 4 years, much like that brief period during quarantine when we were all sent home to contemplate what we were doing with our lives, we had to go back to first principles and we had to contemplate what really matters most. And if we're not imparting that that sort of vision or perspective to our students in the 4 years, we have a great deal of their attention that I don't see how we're not failures.
And I'm just going to chime in and say, I always chuckle when people talk about the tranquility of those early quarantine months, because I had two school age kids at home. So, I mean, those were the least restful months of my life, because if I wasn't cleaning the kitchen, I was fixing a computer. If I wasn't fixing a computer, I was teaching online. If I wasn't teaching online, I was grading. I mean, I don't feel like I slept for the first half of 2020. So I don't begrudge anybody else a peaceful pandemic, but I sure as heck didn't have one. So there's the grumpy old man again. Well, guys, I have been at the wheel for most of this conversation. So in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you two have the last words. And since I've known Jeff longer, I'm going to let him have the penultimate word and let Davey have the ultimate word. So what do you guys want our listeners thinking about liberal arts, Christian education, or whatever else as we head for the door? Jeff, say a few words and then hand the baton to Davey.
And I'll just piggyback with what David was talking about a minute ago, that one of the experiences of that kind of leisure, I think, is friendship, right? Friendship is one of these goods that is non-instrumental. I mean, by definition, I think if your relationship is based upon utility, then it's not friendship. That friendship is ultimately the result of freedom. Those words are related. And maybe it's the highest good of freedom, right? Dante thinks the highest good of freedom is friendship with God. So if the liberal arts enable us to use our freedom well, enable us to be free persons in a positive sense, and not just not just the absence of constraints, but to exercise our freedom appropriately, then I think friendship is kind of at the core. And this project, as Davey recounted, you know, from its inception till ongoing, has been a project rooted in and driven by friendship. So it was encouraging at a time when many of us were kind of going through career life transitions brought about by the pandemic, institutional turmoil. Those friendships, I think, are really sustaining. And the hope is that this book and project can be a kind of invitation to welcome others into these sorts of intellectual friendships, these sorts of leisure-based friendships, and then pursue those in their own communities. Because I can't think of a better outcome, I guess, for a project that was fueled by friendship to then deepen other friendships.
Yeah, and I think I'm just going to add on to what Jeff said, because friendship for me was the thing that was the animating feature of this whole project from start to finish. It was the material cause for the project in the first instance, and it was also something that was created along the way. So there were friendships that started it, and there were friendships that were created, new ones, that I found to be incredibly meaningful over the last, I guess it's now been almost exactly 4 years, Jeff.
Yeah.
Since this all started, which is remarkable. And I think of, you know, one of my favorite lines from one of my favorite books on religious higher ed comes from Mark Schwain, who was a provost at Valparaiso, where I used to teach, and also ran was director of the honors program there for many years. And he talked about the academy being a unique sort of space where community, he says, the academy is where community is a community where pleasure is a friendship and the rigors of work are united. And it's not to say that there aren't other spaces vocationally where friendship and the rigors of work can be united, but I have found it to be uniquely so for the academy. And I will say, you know, it's been a great joy working with Jeff and Jessica and Noah and Rachel and others, because it does remind me at times when I am inclined to be the grumpy old man and the curmudgeon, and to think that, you know, I'm the only one out here caring about this tradition in my own institution, and which is a lie. You know, I think of the story in the Hebrew Bible. I can't remember if it's Elijah or Elisha.
Elijah.
The prophet cries out that there are, you know, I'm alone, and the Lord speaks back to him, there are still 7,000 that have not bowed the knee to Baal. And not to be overly dramatic, but sometimes I feel like academics are inclined to that kind of grumpiness, like we're out here doing all this ourselves and nobody cares about what we're doing. And it's just not true, in my experience at least. And maybe there aren't as many of us out here toiling in the way that we wish, but I don't think it's as hopeless as many of us kind of curmudgeonly academics sometimes think.
Jeff, Davey, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Nathan.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is The Liberating Arts by Plow Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.